Hi, I'm Brian DeShazer, director of the Pacifica Radio Archives, and welcome to another edition of From the Vault, the Archives weekly program that takes our history out of the vault and onto the radio. This week we listen to the historic Pacifica Radio coverage of the bloodiest prison confrontation in American history. September 9, 1971, marked the beginning of the Attica Prison Rebellion. Nearly 1,500 prisoners revolted and held 40 guards hostage while the world awaited the reason for this uprising. Prisoner L.D. Barkley would break the silence on WBAI radio in New York City.
The entire incident that has erupted here at Attica is not a result of the dastardly bushwhacking of the two prisoners September 8th of 1971. But of the unmitigated oppression wrought by the racist administrative network of this prison throughout the year. We are men. We are not beasts, and we do not intend to be beaten or driven as such. What has happened here is but the sound before the fury of those who are oppressed. We call upon all the conscientious citizens of America to assist us in putting an end to this situation that threatens the lives of not only us, but of each and every one of you as well.
The prisoners had authored a manifesto issuing demands for improvements on inhumane living conditions, as well as establishing educational and career training opportunities. 4 days of negotiations ended, and New York State Police and National Guard troops assaulted the rebel prison block. When the smoke cleared, the death toll was 33 prisoners and 10 of the prison guards held hostage. Pacifica's coverage of these 5 chilling days brought into focus a world behind bars that the American public created. The origins of the tragedy of Attica can be traced to conditions inside the prison that very few people were aware of, unless they spent time behind Attica's gates or listened to Pacifica's broadcast. Following the September 13th siege of the prison, all alleged rebel leaders were locked down in 24-hour isolation cells. In February of 1972, Attica began allowing the press to speak to the prisoners. Prisoner Donald Noble, who was responsible for saving the life of hostage Michael Smith when the troops stormed the prison, spoke with WBAI producer Bruce Soloway about the living conditions inside the prison before the rebellion started.
They said the food is all bad. Like one time a guy called an officer over, told the officer there was a worm in the soup, you know. The officer said, well, don't say nothing because you're lucky, at least you got some meat, you know, and all this type of thing, you know. But all these are the conditions that you live here, you know.
Toilet
gotta go as well. You get a roll of toilet paper once a month. You don't get no toothpaste or toothbrush or anything like that. Now, since this disturbance, they started coming around letting you know that if you want some toothpaste, toothbrush, that to turn in the old toothbrush and turn in the old tube of toothpaste, and you would get them. All they say you start getting after the disturbance. But up the line, you wasn't getting this, and you're still getting the toilet paper like once a month. But these are the conditions that you live here. Same thing like in the metal shop where I was working at. Mr. Mills, the head director of industry from Albany, he came here. And everybody ran up to him with all kinds of complaints. You know, dealing with the shop, they had gas, they had paint masses up there, what wasn't good. Because when you use the paint gun, the fumes of it get in your system. And the people were showing them that the masses was no good and all this here. And they asked the doctor for some milk so they could kill these fumes. And this was, the doctor refused this here. So he says that he looked at the mass and seen that they was no good. So he said that he's going to speak to Oswell and try to get some different masses. But he's not for it.
Donald Noble was also one of the creators and authors of the Attica Manifesto. This document was originally written to Attica warden Vincent Mancusi to encourage prison reform within Attica. When Vincent Mancusi gave no indication that these reforms would ever take place under his term, they sent the list of 28 demands to New York State Corrections Commissioner Russell Oswald. Donald Noble describes this process.
Yes, well, I'm one of the men whose names are on a manifesto that was submitted to Oswald.
Tell me something about
it. Yeah, we submitted to a manifesto, 28 demands to Oswald in July. And we also submit one to Rockefeller. We also submit one to Shirley Chisholm. We also submit one to Arthur Eve and different legislative people and lawyers and so forth. You know, we got a beautiful reply back from Oswald sometime in August. You know, he acknowledged our letter and so forth. You know, he was enthused about the way the manifesto was drawn up, because this was more or less coincided with his ideas, you know. And he stated that he's for all these here changes that we talked about, because he see that they are needed, you know, but to give him time. And everybody, you know, they went along with him, because a lot of us had dealing with Oswald for years, you know, being behind, coming back and forth when he's sitting on the parole board. So then different things, like there was things that all he had to do was more or less get in touch with the warden here that would have been went into effect, you know. You know, because it seemed like the way we see it, a lot of us, that if he tells Mancusi, like, to do this here, Mancusi would say, hell with it, you know. I'm going to do my thing, you know, which wasn't nothing.
Perhaps broadcast only on Pacifica Radio in its entirety, prisoner L.D. Barkley reads the manifesto in Attica's central yard. Here it is, unmediated.
To the people of the United States of America, first of all, we want it to be known that in the past we have had some very, very treacherous experiences with the Department of Correction in New York State. They have promised us many things, and they have given us nothing except more of what we already got. Brutalization, murder inside this penitentiary. We do not intend to accept or allow ourselves to accept this situation again. Therefore, we have composed this declaration to the people of America to let them know exactly how we feel and what it is that they must do and what we want primarily, and not what someone else wants for us. We're talking about what we want. The entire, and then and again, it seems to be a little misunderstanding about why this incident developed here at Attica, and this declaration here will explain the reason. The entire incident that has erupted here at Attica is not a result of the dastardly bushwhacking of the two prisoners September 8th of 1971, but of the unmitigated oppression wrought by the racist administrative network of this prison throughout the year. We are men. We are not beasts, and we do not intend to be beaten or driven as such. The entire prison populace, that means each and every one of us here, have set forth to change forever the ruthless brutalization and disregard for the lives of the prisoners here and throughout the United States. What has happened here is but the sound before the fury of those who are oppressed. We will not compromise on any terms except those terms that are agreeable to us. We call upon all the conscientious citizens of America to assist us in putting an end to this situation that threatens the lives of not only us, but of each and every one of you as well. We have set forth demands that will bring us closer to the reality of the demise of these prison institutions that serve no useful purpose to the people of America, but to those who would enslave and exploit the people of America. Our demands are such. We want complete amnesty, meaning freedom from all and any physical, mental, and legal reprisals. We want now speedy and safe transportation out of confinement to a non-imperialistic country. We demand that the federal government intervene so that we will be under direct federal jurisdiction. We want the governor and the judiciary, namely Constance B. Motley, to guarantee that there will be no reprisals. And we want all facets of the media to articulate this. We urgently demand immediate negotiations through William M. Kunstler, attorney at law, 588 9th Avenue, New York, New York. Assemblyman Arthur O'Eve of Buffalo. The Prison Solidarity Committee of New York, Minister Farrakhan from the Muslims. We want Huey P. Newton from the Black Panther Party, and we want the chairman of the Young Lord Party. We want Clarence B. Jones of the Amsterdam News. We want John Wicker of the New York Times. We want Richard Roth from the Courier Express. We want the Fortune Society. Dave Anderson of the Urban League of Rochester. Blind Eva Barnes. We want Jim Ingram of the Democratic Lit Chronicle of Detroit, Michigan. We guarantee the safe passage of all people to and from this institution. We invite all the people to come here and witness this degradation so that they can better know how to bring this degradation to an end. This is what we want. We
right
want
now.
Also, we want Joe Walker from Muhammad Speech Newspapers.
And we want this to be understood. All these people that we've asked for, we love them, and I believe they care something about us. And we don't want them here next year. We want them here now.
One of the people the prisoners asked to come and witness the negotiations was New York State Assembly member Arthur Eve, representing the 143rd District of Buffalo. Eve explains his role in the Attica Rebellion.
Well, I got there on Thursday when I heard over the wire services that the revolt had taken place. I immediately asked the commissioner to allow me to go in because no one had been in to talk with the inmates since the revolt had started. This was about 2 or 3 o'clock. Professor Herman Schwartz from the UB Law School, who had been working on prison legal matters, was there and, you know, said that he would go in also. So we went in as the first set of outsiders who went into DER. There the inmates gave me a list of their five set of demands, first five set points, in which one of them were that they wanted certain people to come to Attica to be observers. My name was one of them. The commissioner, no one ever called me, and I understand that they had given this to the state.
About how long before you came?
In fact, nobody called me. I imagine they, as soon as the revolt was taken over and they were able to sit down and type out a first set of those demands, that it was given to the state within a couple of hours or so. And I guess I got there maybe 3 or 4 hours. When they gave me that list, then I came out and talked with the commissioner about getting these people here, because the inmates said they would not negotiate until those people were there. The commissioner and the state only attempted to get a few, and they, Clarence Jones of the Amsterdam News was one of those that the governor flew in on a private plane, along with several other people. But I found that they were not attempting to get the other people, so I called my office, and they in turn called the Kunstler, the Black Panthers, the Young Lords, Tom Wick of the New York Times, even the guy from a local racist white newspaper in Buffalo that they, some of the inmates wanted, a guy named Charles Roth, who had evidently written a fairly story about prisons. They wanted Minister Farrakhan, black Muslims. They wanted Prison Solidarity Committee. And it was, in fact, they wanted someone from the Urban League of Rochester, a guy named Dave Anderson, and a woman from a poverty program there in Niagara Falls, New York. And I think what it showed was that, you know, the various diverse political philosophies of all of the inmates, but everyone honored everyone else's request, and they were then made a composite list of people, representative of all the people in there, to come.
Assemblymember Arthur Eve describes how the prisoners would communicate with the state of New York.
And because the inmates had told us all along that we could not negotiate for them, we could not make any decisions for them, the observer groups, the best thing we could do was take a message out, since the state would not come in and negotiate with them, get a response, and just bring that back, okay? We could not make any decisions. And, you know, we made that very clear every time we went out, that the best we could do was take a message back to the state and get the state to respond, and we would bring that back. But all decisions would be made by them, because it was their lives that decisions were being made on. And that's why I don't like people to call us negotiators as such. You know, we were an observer group that the men had invited, that whatever was finally negotiated on and agreed to by the state, that we would have been there to ensure that these things would have been implemented, you see, because they had been lied to at other, you know, at the Auburn situation, because I was involved after the Auburn disorders, and where the men had been promised certain things, and instead of getting them, all they had was reprisals. They were put in cells for 90 to 120 days at Auburn. So the men knew that the credibility of the state and the superintendent was very, very bad. But when Saturday came, Bobby Seals came, and all of us went in with Bobby along with the press. Each time we went, I want to repeat, the press went in. The press had the opportunity to document everything that was said, you know, the interviews with the hostages, everything. But Bobby went in, and we all went in with Bobby, and we were told, you know, to come out when, you know, Bobby left. Bobby went in, talked with a few of the inmates, sort of the leadership, and got a picture of what was going on. And he said that he had to leave and come back and later the next morning, Sunday morning at 7. But he was going to talk to Brother Huey Newton and talk with the committee back in L.A. But, you know, he couldn't tell them what to do. He wasn't going to make any recommendation, you know.
Co-founder of the Black Panther Party, Bobby Seale.
Really what happened is that I went to Oakland, California, Sunday. I arrived in Oakland, California, West Coast time at 3 o'clock. West Coast time at 12 o'clock that same Sunday afternoon, I caught a plane back. This was the original intended plan in the first place. Went back to confer with the Central Committee of the Black Panther Party. We're not individualists in the party, and it's just one of those things where we have to have some kind of democratic centralized functions. And I reported to them the situation. I explained to the Central Committee that some more legal and political support was going to be necessary, and that the brothers had explained to me that they wanted me to hurry up and go to Oakland and come on back with any kind of negotiative guidance that they could decide on. These were the prisoners who told me this, the 22 minutes that I was inside the prison Saturday night prior to going to Oakland Sunday. I came back. Well, wait a minute. Let me back up a little bit. While I was there in Oakland, the Central Committee decided it was very necessary that right away I should get on the phone, try to contact William Kunstler inside the prison, and see if William Kunstler could get Oswald, the commissioner, on the phone. This was done. Oswald came on the phone, and I had told Oswald what the Central Committee said that I should tell Oswald. And what I told Oswald was basically that the prisoners had stated to me before I left that Saturday night while I was inside, the prisoners had stated to me that they would not kill or release any of the guards, at least until I return to help out with more negotiative guidance that they could decide on. Now, this is what the prisoners told me. Now, I told Oswald that. He says, well, what are you going to do? I said, I'm on my way back. I'll be there tomorrow morning.
Again, Arthur Eve.
I'd like to get to the Saturday night thing leading into Sunday morning because this is a critical point. First of all, the inmates allowed and insisted that Officer Quinn, the one who ultimately died that Saturday, they insisted that the state sent in a stretcher so that they could get him out of there because they felt that he was had been seriously injured. The inmates insisted that a doctor be allowed to come in and to treat the hostages. The inmates gave the state a list of the hostages that they had because from just observing, evidently the state hadn't even ascertained who the hostages were that they had in. The inmates provided that list and asked for medical records of each of the hostages that they had. And there were a number of hostages from 7 to 11 that were allowed to leave if they had a history of heart, you know, condition or asthmatic conditions or anything that might, in fact, staying inside might jeopardize their lives. So I want to make it very clear that the impression given that the inmates did not care about the hostages' lives and did, in fact, not treat them, you know, humane while they were inside, that is not so. In fact, the hostages slept on single and double mattresses while most of the inmates slept on the ground. The hostages were covered during the day by sort of a makeshift tent that they had built in order to protect them from the sun. And the doctor who volunteered, and I must commend this man, it was a white doctor, a surgeon who answered to the call for volunteer out of that whole area. and he was allowed to go in freely, back and out, without any stopping. In fact, when he went in, the inmates would lead him over to the hostages first, and he would always check them out first, and then he would look at some of the other inmates, because there were men in there who had asthmatic condition, heart conditions, and other things. And he said to the press that the inmates were taking better care of the hostages than they were themselves, that the hostages ate more, that they drank more, and they had more of everything. And the inmates were doing this. The state was not making that determination. So I want to get that straight from the very beginning.
From my people and comrades from Attica State Prison, they have informed us, we that are trying to serve our people, that an officer that has been mentioned by the press, which has been using rhetorics and trying to destroy what really, really happened, is that the officer died of a heart attack. Right? This officer was sent to the hospital by the prison administration. Later on, 2 days later, this officer passed away in the hospital. Now, this administration, run by Bancusi, and now who is in command, Oswald, and his supreme commander, Rockefeller, is trying to charge us with murder. This is not so. So we are, myself and our people in Attica, are trying to tell you that we did not murder this officer.
Arthur Eve explains how the state was using the media to publicly demonize the prisoners.
It's my understanding that there were only one sandwich per day for the
inmates. That's right. When the sandwiches were sent in, approximately 1,300 sandwiches, this is what they told us. Now, again, I don't know. They said approximately, the state was saying 13 sandwiches were going in. The inmates gave the hostages as much as they wanted to eat. If they felt two sandwiches were, you know, what they needed, they got two. Where the inmates at times had to divide, you know, and take a third of a sandwich or two-thirds or what. They rationed it out so that they then divided among themselves equally what was left after the hostages ate. And I want to make this very clear. They, you know, took very good care of them. To see the stories after I got out, you know, that had been written, you know, just was, you know, unbelievable. And I think it points up, you know, the inmates had a television set inside. They had a portable radio. And every time we went in, you know, they let the press come in. They insisted that, you know, all the major networks and everything else. And they had a pool out front where they would pick X number of guys to go in. And they knew the things that were being recorded. They knew the statements that were being made, you know, and the hostages were saying that they were being treated well and so forth, you know, and how they were being treated even better. And they should, you know, and they were shown the area. You know, the doctor told the news media how the hostages were being treated better and so forth. But then they saw on the TV tubes that this was not what was going out into the world. And they then, you know, knew that the system was again attempting to polarize and to make the outside world look upon them as, you know, animals or beasts or people who were not sensitive to human life. So, you know, all the days that they were in there, they knew that things would go back to the studios, be edited, and only those things that people wanted to use to further polarize this country was the things that were going out. So I want you to know that they were very well aware of the distortions, the, you know, untruths, and the kinds of editing that the major networks of this country and the news media were doing. So on Saturday, you know, in fact, when they said that Quinn was thrown out of a second floor window, you know, and they said this Thursday, you know, when he was, you know, when he came out, they said it Friday, then he died Saturday, I believe, and, you know, the papers repeated it, thrown out of a second floor window.
The claim by the administration is that the correction officer who died was thrown from a second floor window.
Say it out loud.
Will you answer that for the press, please?
Yes. I wish I had some kind of way to show you the bars in front of the window, so you can understand and see for yourself See for yourself. How can a man throw himself out a window while the bars are no larger than at least around 6 inches?
Well, if you've ever been in Attica and been at a maximum security penal institution, you know that there's bars on the first floor windows. You know, it's humanly impossible to throw a 200-pound man out of a second-floor window in a prison, you see. But again, you know, the state did not correct these kinds of vicious lies because it was all part of their further polarization, helping, hopefully, they felt, to give the public, you know, support for them to go in and to do ultimately what they did.
Perhaps most powerful were the sounds of the public pleas of the corrections officers being held hostage within the walls of Attica.
Whatever people they have on the roofs, outside, anybody with a weapon, anybody with anything of a militant manner, leave. Just get him off the roof.
How about the request that Governor Rockefeller make an appearance here?
I'd suggest he get his ass here now. I'd like to say this. I think I'm speaking for all of us. We're not scared of any of you people. We know it's not you hurting us, but the people outside, the governor, the people that elected the governor, and all the people in the United States, we're awaiting their decision, and we want to see them meet all your demands. Again, I say I really want, and we all want, the people on the roofs to get off.
Mike, in making the statement you just made that it's not the people in here who are hurting you, but it's the people outside, have you been coached to make that statement? Any pressure, any promise, anything of any kind?
But no.
Can you say something convincing in that regard? Because it will sound so to many people.
Yes, I think that the unity as one, white brothers, black brothers, Puerto Rican brothers, all you people show that you've got yourselves together. The mere fact that we haven't been injured.
Yeah, I have a family.
Yes, I have a wife. I have a daughter born May 26, 1971. I wish I could be home with them. We all wish we could be home. By we, I don't mean 38 of us. I mean all of us. All 1,538 of us.
When it was evident the state of New York was losing interest in negotiating, Attorney William Kunstler made a prediction on the state's next move.
Do you think they will really sacrifice the guards before they will agree to the demands of the prison?
Yeah, I had hoped the guards would not be expendable, but I think from the reaction here that they are expendable.
Did you say the guards are expendable?
If the governor's remarks mean that he won't come and intervene, then I come to the conclusion the guards' lives are expendable.
Do you think that Commissioner Oswald has another alternative?
Of course he has an alternative. Time. Just to wait. And prisoners said they would take no action whatsoever if they had more time. And it seemed to me that time, in all justice and humanity, should have been given. Time can make, you know, a lot of shades of difference in negotiation, and time can save lives. And I would think that no stone should have been unturned in order to save those lives. They want to kill 39 guards and 1,500 prisoners. That's one thing. If they have any respect for human life, time is a lot easier to buy than life.
In time, isn't the only way to get out of this really to grant the amnesty that they're asking?
Well, but there are shades of amnesty. There are ways to negotiate it. There are lots of things that could be done.
What's the shade of amnesty that might be acceptable to the prisoners?
The governor might promise commutation, immediate commutation. He might promise a certain limit on punishment. He might promise executive clemency and executive pardon. I mean, there are a dozen different ways in which that cat could be skinned.
A few moments ago, state police troopers moved into the unsecured areas of the institution to restore order under specific orders to only use force to meet force or to protect the lives, if possible, of the hostages. At the same time, a riot control gas was dispersed at 9:48 by helicopters in an effort to immobilize persons in the unsecured area.
And the noise that you hear in the background right now is the riven up of the helicopters. And the time is 9:45. And I'm here. And I'm supposed to be reporting this, and I'm supposed to be unemotional. But my people, my brothers in there, are going to be slaughtered. And it's very difficult to be a professional reporter this time. Our consulate has been refused admittance, and now one is going off. One Army helicopter is taken off. That means that they are now beginning to attack. You don't have to be in Vietnam. Vietnam is here now. This is it.
Again, Arthur E.
All of us said we were getting ready to leave, and I was the last one to leave the prison because they provided transportation to the airport for all the legislators. And when I got outside, the newsmen stopped me and they said, Mr. E., what do you have to say? And my response to them was that I'd never understand to the day I die why the governor did not come and talk to us. I said, we didn't ask him to come and talk to the inmates. We didn't say, come and talk about amnesty. We said, come and talk to us. And then I mentioned, I said, you know, this group included the three white conservative legislators from this area, Emory, Walkley, Senator McGowan, you know, Bobby Garcia, Herman Bedelio, myself, say, Clarence Jones, who just bought the Amsterdam News, you know, for millions, you know. I said, Tom Wick of the New York Times, I said, plus other people, Senator John Dunn, you know, we all asked him to come and talk to us, to stop a massacre, you know. And I said, I'll never understand why, you know, the man did not come.
Early in his career, comedian Richard Pryor was broadcasting that summer on Pacifica radio station KPFA in Berkeley, California. He edited a series of New York State Correction Commissioner Russell Oswald statements on Attica to create this bit that aired that weekend following Attica in September of 1971.
We have some interesting things for you tonight. This is a little thing that Alan Farley and I worked out together. It's a comedy album. It's not been released yet, but it's going to be a monster. I think it's called The Button-Down Mind of Russell Oswald, famous Attica comedian. And I guess we'll hear it now.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, the star of our show, that funny man himself, Mr. Decision Maker, Russell Oswald!
Let's see if I can review for you, if I can, a few of the things that entered into this most agonizing and decision I've probably ever made in my life. In any emergency of this kind, the state police would lead the way in, because it was always assumed that, and I don't know whether it's a proper assumption or not, but it was always assumed that correction officers, being embroiled in a situation such as this, might be vindictive. In going in, and the state police, who are a tremendously well-disciplined and a fine organization, would go in coolly and Forty killed, as you know. There are maybe another 300 who have some bruises.
How did that false report, that so, I think, inflamed the public generally and everybody, that hostages had their throats cut, how did that thing get started?
Well, I've tried to reconstruct that myself. I would say now, at the outset, that our own department, on occasions, did not report as well as we might have. It was under tremendous tensions, tremendous pressures. People were reporting at all times, no time to verify. The press was interviewing almost anyone who came out of the institution who looked like an official or an unofficial visitor there. There was a story put out by a guard that these throats had been cut. There was a story put out by a police sergeant that these throats had been cut. I believe one of my staff said the throats had been cut. Someone said I said they had. And so far as I know, no one has been able to prove to me yet that I did. I hope I didn't. Someone said I said they had.
The leaders never returned, but callously herded eight hostages within our view with weapons at their throat.
Someone said they had. And so far as I know, no one has been able to prove to me yet that I did. I hope I didn't.
Callously herded eight hostages within our view with weapons at their throat.
Someone said I said they had.
Callously herded eight hostages within our view.
Someone said I said they had. And so far as I know, no one has been able to prove to me yet that I did. I hope I didn't.
Callously herded eight hostages within our view with weapons at their throat.
I believe one of my staff said the throats had been cut. Someone said I said they had. And so far as I know, no one has been able to prove to me yet that I did. I hope I didn't.
Hard to believe, isn't it?
I saw a sniper from the state police who told me that a man was pulling a knife across this inmate's throat. Just as the takeover of the institution was begun, and that as he pulled the knife across the throat, he had about this much of the back of him showing, and he felt he had to get him, and he killed 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 him. And that man came into my office thereafter and was shown on TV, as you may know.
The one with
his throat was badly cut. Now, I did see, correction.
You meant a hostage. You said an inmate.
A hostage. I'm sorry. Several of the hostages had had their blindfolds dropped around their neck, had been shot in the head. It was all bloody around the blindfolds. This was given to me by the pathologist. There was a sense of confusion. Certainly, no deliberate attempt to deceive, because the facts would come out anyhow. One has to be prepared for possible difficulties. I think without question that there are some of these hardcore Maoists who would love to start the thing up again, and who will get support and what help they can from people on the outside. Some of the things those prisoners asked for, you and I, you would be shocked to think that they weren't getting. For instance, how would you like it if you were told that you could only have a shower 52 times a year? How would you like it if you only got a roll of toilet paper every 5 weeks? How would you like it if you spent 16 hours, or 60% of your time is what I want to say, in a cell? One can't rehabilitate people by keeping them in cells.
Hard to believe, isn't it?
How, Mr. Oswald, would you handle a situation if there were an Attica tomorrow?
I don't know. I really and truly don't know. It would be easy to say I'd do the same thing again, but I don't know. It's never the same situation. You know, there are always some variables. And I would have to look at it if it came. And God forbid that another one comes anywhere in the country. I pity the poor person who has to go through that kind of decision at any time.
Agonizing decision. I pray to God that this works out for the best interest of all of us.
Hard to believe, isn't it?
I pray to God.
For you don't count the dead when God's on your side.
This works out for the best interest of all of us.
Hope you liked that.
After a week of interviewing inmates, the National Lawyers Guild held a press conference outside the prison wall. The speakers for the Lawyers Guild were Jeffrey Hass and Joshua Roth.
Now, many of the general circumstances of the massacre of September 13th have already been made public. At this time, we have sufficient corroborating evidence to substantiate that inmate Frank Hicks was deliberately singled out and killed after he had surrendered and been placed in custody. Our evidence shows that after the yard was secured, Hicks was singled out by name and separated from the other prisoners. An X was placed on his back, and he was led into a cell block by prison guards and troopers. He was never seen alive again. His name appears among the reported dead. The only conclusion that we can make is that he was executed. In securing the institution, state troopers and prison guards had been led to believe, from statements released by prison officials, that several of the hostages had their throats slashed and that at least one hostage had been castrated. These lies further embittered and enraged the guards and troopers who had been waiting for 5 days at the gates of Attica for orders to go in. Their bitterness and rage was exercised on the inmates in the shootings, assassinations, and systematic beatings which followed. The brutality on September 13th was accompanied by constant references to the statements of prison officials, which had and still so poisoned the minds of the guards that they continue to terrorize the prisoners in spite of the results of the 3 autopsy reports, which totally contradict the official statements. Governor Rockefeller and prison officials provoked the police riot, which caused the deaths of 41 persons and the shootings and beatings of hundreds more. We hereby call for the indictment of Governor Rockefeller, Commissioner Oswald, Deputy Commissioner Dunbar, Warden and Warden Mancusi, and Deputy Warden Vincent for assault, mayhem, and murder. We'd also like to make some observations that the persons in Attica risked their lives to expose the conditions here and in other American prisons. That the response of the governor and other officials is not to deal with the conditions and the terribleness of the conditions which was raised, but it is to silence and punish the persons who raised those issues.
Rockefeller, I think he is a complete murderer. Nothing else but a murderer. I know I suffered in all these weeks and everything since. I hope this man never has another peaceful night's sleep. Never. Never.
Attorney William Kunstler reflects on the lessons learned from Attica from this talk recorded in 1973.
The other night at the law school at UB, there was a symposium in which I and a judge from Detroit Recorder's Court, Justin Rabbits, appeared, and there was a police officer by the name of Kirkland. And Mr. Kirkland got up and said, "There's one lesson that you better learn fast, that whether a man or a woman has a good job or no job, they get equally hungry. And that when they are hungry and they have no job, they are not going to die without a struggle. They're going to seize food. Very few of us really starved or even hungered. Virtually every want is in some way met. There isn't a gnawing feeling of eternal oppression. There isn't the reaction day in and day out of being despised, or at least feeling that you're being despised. There aren't the psychological trauma and the physical trauma of every day's living as a black person, or a poor white, or a Chicano field hand, or a Puerto Rican in Spanish Harlem, or a Native American, or a woman. And not feeling a great deal of this,
and not wanting to feel it, or not being capable of feeling it, leads us into making these nice distinctions. They should have used more peaceful means of expression. And yet, in our secret hearts, we understand that no one, probably in this room or this city or this state or this nation, would have ever given essentially one day's thought to prison conditions had it not been for those 43 deaths, that no one would really even feel the first twinge of understanding of what Native Americans go through had it not been for Wounded Knee. And the question, that's a hard one to answer for everyone, is when will people fight, kill, die, go into the valley for what they believe in and what they need? And when will the outside world begin to understand that this drive for survival is so powerful and so irresistible and so much a natural part of human or animal life that people will go to any length to preserve themselves and their brothers and sisters, and that to talk philosophically about it or abstractly has no meaning, whether you're talking about Palestinian Arabs or the people of Ulster and the Irish Republic, or of people in Vietnam, or in any of the former Portuguese colonies, or in Rhodesia, and the Union of South Africa, and so many other places that crop up in the newspapers almost as if they are a regular progression of each other. And not to understand it is to lead to greater tragedy, because the countervalue is to oppose it with force. The countervalue is to destroy it without concerning yourself with its validity, its reasons for being.
And we end this program with comments again from New York State Assembly member Arthur Eve.
But I want to say this to the brothers, especially blacks and Puerto Ricans, you know, that those inmates said, you know, get yourself some knowledge, get your minds together, you know, unite, you know, that we've got to be in every place. Those men understood revolution. They knew that here they invited me, a man who was somewhat a part of the system as far as a public official. You know, but they knew that everyone, if they have commitment, this is why education is so important to us, because if we don't get a good education, if we go through a genocide murdering system as they do, I'm sure, in the schools in New York, as they do in Buffalo, because they're just killing our kids through the Buffalo public school system, you know, that they can't even begin to seek knowledge and truth, you see. And this is why it's important that we own radio stations, you know, that we own newspapers, that we own TV stations, so that the truth, you see, and not the edited stuff that comes out to us, get out, you see. But, you know, I made a commitment to the inmates, and they said to us, go out and tell the truth. And they said, tell nothing but the truth. Okay, don't add to it, don't distract, and that's why, you know, everything I'm telling you, and if I say that, you know, this is something I assume or something, I will say that. But other than that, everything that I've said has been what I saw, what I experienced, and what was told to me by Deputy Commissioner Walter Dunbar. Okay. Now, you know, this has been confirmed by Bobby Garcia and Herman Bedelio as far as what happened after it was all over. And I think that, you know, if I can live just long enough to tell it to as many people, and hopefully that we, even those 10 hostages who died, their families realized that they were expendable, that the governor really didn't give a damn about them, and that if the governor's brother or son or daughter or relative had been in there, just one of them, not 38 hostages, I'm sure he would have come to Attica to talk to the Observer Committee. But they've proved that the ruling class, the ones who own the corporations, I'm not talking about the blacks who think they're making 40 or 100,000 a year, 200,000 a year, that they're part of the ruling class. You know, they're just fooling themselves, okay? They're just fooling themselves. I own a black newspaper. You know, I'm a state assemblyman. You know, I thought I was an important, you know, that the mayor wouldn't dare, you know, do something like that to me, you know. And, you know, even though I've been saying that he's not sensitive to human life, I didn't realize to what extent, you see. So the message is that all oppressed people, if you work for any kind of living, you're part of the expendable group, you know. And I think this is something that we must realize, that the country is going towards a fascist form of government. New York State was leading the nation in the transition, and that when you take repression coupled with fear, that political equation is fascist form of government. And that we are so close to it that it's unbelievable, and that we will only survive if by pulling ourselves together, utilizing every group and every talent that we have, and making this system responsive to human life, or else we're all dead. We're all dead.
And that does it for this week's edition of From the Vault, marking the anniversary of the 1971 Attica Prison Rebellion. We'd like to thank TalkingHistory.org for making the raw Pacifica coverage of the event available to the public and for contextualizing the subject that helped shape today's program. Stay tuned for future programs on the 1968 founding of the American Indian Movement, a rare find of poet Charles Bukowski, and more from the 1975 San Diego Folk Music Festival. This series is produced by Brian DeShazer and Mark Torres, and executive produced by the Pacifica Radio Archives and Brian DeShazer. Today's program was written by Mark Torres. We are now streaming and podcasting online at FromTheVaultRadio.org. For more information or to join us in our efforts to preserve more of the historic collection, visit us at PacificaRadioArchives.org or call the archives at 1-800-735-0230. From the Vault is presented as part of the Pacifica Radio Archives Preservation and Access Project, which is supported in part by an award from the National Endowment for the Arts and grants from the Grammy Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the University of California Berkeley's Moffitt Library, the Pacifica Foundation, and from contributions from Pacifica station listeners. Our theme music is by Kevin Drum Holiday. I'm Brian DeShazer, and thanks for listening.